Hey guys, in this AB Talks with Sarah, you will listen to a bold, resilient woman who's willing to be vulnerable and share her story with you that hopefully will benefit a lot of people.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Can we start?
Yes. Okay. Okay, we're good. Yeah.
So we start by saying, how are you really doing?
I'm good. I just got back from Mexico, so I'm just trying to catch up with myself. I went on a trip to ground myself and I came back further away from Earth than possible. So I'm just trying to figure out kind of how I actually am. And I haven't had the time to ask myself that. So thank you for asking. I don't know, I feel messy. I feel messy today and tired.
Do you feel messy because you still didn't build back your routine or?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't had routine this entire year though. It's kind of just been like, whatever I feel like doing, I'll do. And for some reason that's drinking a lot. So yeah.
Okay. What made you smile today?
I don't know if I can say it.
Say anything you want.
This guy that I have been seeing, I called him earlier today so I was just like, hey, I need a pep talk. I'm feeling really exhausted. And so he gives me this pep talk and then he ends the call with like, he's like, okay, go kill it. Love you, bye. And he's never said that before. And so I just watch him spiral and he's like, wah! And then he hangs up the phone. And I just sit there laughing because like, I know he didn't mean to say it, but it was just like, it was adorable. And yeah.
It is beautiful because we put so many filters and so many safeguards. We all do it. I do it. Maybe you do it. And we always are so afraid to be, I think vulnerability is also training. You train yourself to be vulnerable because everything else teaches you not to be, you know? So that moment with the guy you're dating is a nice moment, you know? It's a pure moment, I would say.
Yeah, it was definitely pure. And I think I put a lot of pressure on him saying, I don't want him to say it yet. And like, I've seen him almost say it a few times and I'm just like, and I run away. And so like, I think I just need to be more accepting of like those moments because it doesn't need to have, like, I love you doesn't need to have the weight that, you know, we put on it. It doesn't, it should just be natural. Like you say, like candid and vulnerable and it's like, whatever, yeah.
How did you respond, saying thank you or you actually said, I love you?
No, I said, because he freaked out, so I was like, it's okay, bye.
I want to go way back. I want to rewind. So we'll start by asking, how was your childhood?
It's such a complex question. Which part?
Whatever part.
My childhood if I had a word for it, I mean, it was great and it was terrible. It affected my entire life as an adult. So I grew up in Australia. My parents immigrated from Palestine and Jordan. And yeah, it was really conflicting because at home we were being raised super conservative, very like, I want to say very like traditional. And then when I was at school, I was surrounded by a bunch of white kids who were very rebellious and completely against anything my parents were teaching us. So I never really found a world where I fit in. And I've said this before, but like at home, I was, you know, too Western for my parents. And then at school, I was too Arab for my peers. So it was like, it was just really complicated. And then beyond that, there was like things that were happening behind closed doors at home that were fucking with like the way I perceived myself as a woman, I would say, or a girl at the time. I don't know, it was complex. You gotta be more specific.
And your relationship with your parents, how would you describe them?
I would say I feel like today I play the role of my parents to my parents. I'm very protective over them. I feel like no one ever asks my mom how she is, really. Like, and so I feel like whenever we get on the phone and I ask her how she's doing, it's like no one's asked her that since we last spoke. Like, she gets so consumed in that answer, and it just makes me feel so sad that I can't be there for her, because I know she's being the mom for everyone else and no one's being the mom for her. And so I want to say my mom and I are very, very close. My dad and I love him, but we don't really talk as much as I do. Like, I speak to my mom every day, every morning, our time difference, like my morning, her night, she says goodnight to me. Like, on, she'll just send me a Facebook message, and if I don't respond, she'll be like, hello? And she'll keep messaging me and calling me until I just say goodnight back, because she just wants to make sure, like, I'm alive and well. So that's kind of the relationship we have.
Yeah, I think a good point that you mentioned is who cares for the caretaker and who photographs the photographer?
Yeah.
And that's always, sometimes when I see the photographers working with us and I'm like, bro, just come in the picture, let anybody take a picture at the end, because you're never on camera, you're never seen, and who gives you the attention that you're giving everybody else? So your mother falls into that pocket, you know?
Yeah, but it keeps me up at night. Like, I really worry about her. And I've been this way since I was a child, because I feel like I wasn't protected as a kid as much as they thought they were protecting me. And so, you know, I would wake up in the middle of the night when the house was quiet, because my parents would always stay up till 4 a.m. watching Turkish TV and Arabic TV. And like, I'd always hear the drama, the soap operas that they watch, and there's just so much yelling and screaming on the coming from the TV. And so after 4 a.m. when it was quiet and they've gone to bed, I would wake up, because suddenly the silence was so deafening, because I'm so used to, you know, the loud noise. And I would fear for them. I would get out of bed and I would be the one to go and check on them to make sure they're alive and they're good, because I didn't have them doing that to me. And it was just this weird, like, reverse role that I was playing as a child, which was super interesting, but it carries on till today. Like, my biggest fear is, like, my mom passing away, because she plays like this. I just feel so protective over her, but she fills my heart in such a way that I don't think it could ever be replaced. Like, I mean, and a lot of people can say this about their moms, but it would keep me up at night, the fear of losing my mom, because I don't know, it's a weird thing that I have. Like, it haunts me. It's so strange.
It makes you anxious?
It makes me sad. I just don't know what life would be like without this woman who constantly is there, you know?
Do you think worrying so much about your mother, and, you know, God bless her and give her a long, healthy life, but worrying about that, do you think it spoils the moment?
Of what moment, though?
Present, now.
Yeah, it does. And I've gotten better at nurturing these thoughts and knowing they're coming from a place of fear, and not, like, what is the point of thinking, like, life and death is inevitable. We're all going to die. So it's just very strange that this was the thing my mind decided to, like, obsess over, like, the fear of losing my mom. Like, why that specific thing of all things? And but no, I, in this day and age, in this present time, I'm doing a really great job of not thinking that way, but it is something that haunted me, like, over the years.
It's a very normal thing, I think, and I think a lot of us, and you were asking yourself the question, like, why this specific thing is haunting you. But I thought it's extremely normal, because your mother obviously plays such a huge role in you, that you're so protective of her, and she's so dear to you, and she's irreplaceable, like you mentioned. So just knowing that if that person is gone, what a void they would leave and how much you would miss them, is by default scary. Like, I'm scared for you.
Thank you.
And I am very close to my mother, so I would understand and I accept that when her life will come to an end, and I hope also she has a beautiful, healthy, long life, but I know she's irreplaceable and I have to accept that, you know, but I have to also be extremely grateful, and you should with me, we should be very grateful for them, for being able to share our lives with such human beings.
Yeah.
It's a privilege, it's a blessing, you know?
Yeah, and with that, like, I often catch myself getting annoyed that my mom messages me constantly until I reply, but then I always have to ground myself in the fact that I'm so blessed to have a woman who cares about me this much. And that always, like, it's just like, you have to be grateful. You can't get annoyed. Like, this is, you are her life as much as she is yours. And like, even though she pesters me and she drives me insane sometimes, like, it's coming from a place of love and care. So you can't get angry at that. You just have to be grateful, you know? Mm-hmm.
Is it true that with your parents regarding your work, you don't discuss work because you'll never see eye to eye?
It's bigger than that. My relationship with my art is, it's obviously very personal. It comes from like so deep within. I have been westernized in this way. I have been colonized. My mind is very different to the way my mom thinks as an art of woman, you know? And so when she sees, when she has seen my work in the past, and instead of calling me, she'll call my sister and she'll just be crying her eyes out. She's like, how can Sarah say these things? Why is she saying fuck? Why is there women naked? And like, and then eventually when she calms down and my sister's like, it's just art, mom, like, don't worry, like, it's not who Sarah is or whatever. She'll call me and my sister's already given me the heads up. She's like, Sarah, mom called, she saw your latest series, she's not happy. And I'm like, yes, mom, I know you saw my work. Do you want to talk about it? And she'd be like, why do you do this to me? Like, and like, just like always makes it about herself. And I'm like, mom, it's not about you. And you know, we used to fight so much about it, and cause she just can't understand the way we think in this generation in white space, in Western spaces, like, because she's so Arab in this way. She still got that Middle Eastern mentality and she didn't change. Like, she came to Australia, they've been there for over, I think, 40 years now. And she is still as Arab as the day she came. And so it's like, there's no leniency. And so I said to her, I was like, mom, I want to maintain our relationship. I love you so much. Let's just agree to never talk about my art. Let's just never discuss it, because you're not going to understand how I think. And that's just it. And, you know, we can't keep going back and forth. So let's just agree to disagree. And she was like, okay, Sarah. But then every time we get on the phone, even to this day, she's like, are you behaving in your art? You said you're shooting today. What are you shooting? And like, she's just always trying to find out. But yeah, I have to protect her, especially with my latest series, Ev. Like, she hasn't seen it. I had to call all my cousins, my aunties, and my siblings. And I was just like, guys, I'm doing this series. It's very provocative. It's the first time I'm modeling in my work, and I'm saying the things that I've always said in my work. I'm telling my story. And if mom sees it, she's going to disown me or never speak to me again, or just like give me hell for the rest of my life. So let's all actively work together to make sure she doesn't see this series. And they're like, okay, Sarah, yeah, because they all support me. But and so she hasn't seen it to date. And it's really funny because a lot of my followers are like, has your mom seen it? I see you're posting her. Does that mean she supports you? Like, they're so excited thinking like she didn't react, but the reality is she still hasn't seen the work. So
what, yeah. About your dad?
I don't know. He's always like, when my mom's like nagging about my art, he's always just like, Khaliha, like, it's art, like, let her be. But I think when this series might affect both of them. So, but I haven't really thought about the consequences of what my dad would do if he sees it. I think he's very hypocritical in the way he responds. Like sometimes he's like super angry and then sometimes he doesn't give a fuck. So it's like, I never know what to expect with him. It really just depends on his mood. Mm. So, yeah.
How was the school?
School? I mean, it was, why is that such a hard question? Primary school was tough. My parents put us in a very private, wealthy, I want to say very much white school. And there was only a handful of brown kids. I don't even think there was maybe one black kid in our class of 60, but it was very much white, very Western. And this is when I'm still developing and figuring out my place in the world. And so I was still very much, I was still very much Arab. I hadn't been colonized yet. And so in primary school, I was definitely picked on. I was bullied a lot by the girls and the boys. And I never really felt like I fit in. And I wasn't prepared to change because the people that I cared about the most were still my parents. And so it wasn't until my parents moved me to a different school, a Christian school, that I decided I didn't want to be bullied anymore. I wanted to be the cool kid. And so what could I change about myself in order to fit into these white spaces? And so when I moved schools, I came in with this whole new attitude to protect myself. And I wore my hair like the kids at my primary school did. I was very rude. I had an attitude. And yeah, it was this protective mechanism that I put on in order to exist safely in these spaces. And so in high school, I was actually a cool kid, but that means nothing in this day. But at the time when you're young, that's all you care about fitting in and being accepted. And I want to say my high school was very different and my primary school was very isolating and it was hard. Yeah, I got called a dirty Arab. And when 9/11 happened, everyone referred to me as the terrorist. And cause I was the only Arab in my class, things like that. It was just, but then high school was very different. So.
So the tactic worked, being rude and wearing different clothes and a different attitude made you actually popular or cool.
It did for the first few years. And then I got really, I actually got really sick. I had an anorexia from grade 8 to 10. And when you're that psychologically consumed with the way you look, at the time I had very little awareness of the way I was speaking to other people. And I brought down a lot of girls with me. And I ended up being extremely toxic and developing toxic relationships that were built on power and control. And so, yeah, there was a time in grade 9 where everyone at school didn't talk to me anymore because I turned two girls sick with me. I was just very, it was toxic. It was terrible. And it was hard for me because I was wow, no one at school wants to talk to me. I'm getting calls from some of the girls being if you ever come back, we're going to fucking destroy you and come after you. It was just bad. And then I was all right, I need to get better because this is not a way to live. And so by grade 10, 11, I actually found safety in Christianity again. And I became very religious again for the last 2 years of my high school. And then after that, we went off the rails again. So, yeah, I don't know.
You're very open about being sexually abused. And my question is, how bad was it?
How bad was the abuse as a child?
Yes.
I'm not that open. I'm a little thrown off. It was bad. It wasn't, thankfully, it wasn't I mean, in terms of, sorry, I didn't know how to talk about this. That's a really bad question. You can't just ask that. Fuck. It was bad. It went on for like 10 years and it was not just like one person. It was three different people, all doing it privately. It wasn't just happening to me. It was happening to other members of, you know, the family. And we all grew up fucked up because of it. And we all had a really, really weird relationship with our bodies and our sexuality and these desires that made absolutely no sense. But we thought we were just assuming before we uncovered, like, it was coming from a place of like the way we learned affection and love and validation by men. And so it's fucked. It's all fucked up. I don't know what to say. What do you want to know?
I just want you to be as comfortable telling me whatever you want to tell me. I'm not pushy and I don't want to be pushy. I just want, like I told you, the show, Sarah, is about human beings. And we've all been through fucked up experiences. Maybe not all, maybe some people are a bit more fortunate, but I also refer to sometimes unfortunate experiences can be turned very fortunately. Like, it can be your asset, it can be your edge that nobody has. And you can probably empathize with somebody who's been abused way more than a person who has a flowery life. That cannot relate or help somebody who's in need. So I don't want to say that everybody goes through these tough experiences. Some do and some don't. But the whole point is to ask you your story and how you are able to celebrate your life and accept it with the salt, the pepper, the sugar, everything that makes your journey or your art. I call your life or our lives a piece of art. So it has all kinds of colors. How young were you?
I think it started at 3. My earliest memory was around 3 or 4. Yeah.
You can remember 3 years old?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And
it took work. It's not something you just like remember. It takes being triggered and your trauma brain to be activated to then see like the memories. And you don't ever get the full picture. You just get like sensations or like physical feelings or like a flash, like a literally how they portray it in movies. Obviously it came from truth. Like you get like a flash, like a moment and you're like, the fuck? What the fuck am I seeing right now? Where is this coming from? And it's about giving your brain and your soul and your body permission to allow access to those memories. And that takes deep internal reflection and introspective. And it takes microdosing on mushrooms, like honestly, and just like anything that allows you to feel safe to enter those really traumatic experiences. And yeah, that's I guess that's how you remember things.
There is something that has been repeated a few times that I've seen even on YouTube, which is theta healing. I don't know how popular it is in LA.
What
but
is it called? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Theta healing.
Theta?
Theta healing. And it's a lot about kind of a therapy or a meditation that takes you back into your childhood experiences and traumas. And the trauma is not necessarily rape, for example. It could be somebody, just your parents saying, you look really fat. And from that moment, that little thing stuck somewhere in your head and made you insecure for the next rest of your life because of that comment. So the traumas can be very varied, but that's what the theta healing, apparently they take you back so you can untangle and address these things that you probably have blocked all these years, you know?
Yeah. No, that's true. I think in the first 5 years of our lives, we create beliefs. And then from there on, that's how we develop as humans, based on those beliefs that we've made based on what our parents or our surroundings or our environment has taught us. And so I think in my situation, by the time I moved to America, I had all these beliefs about myself and, you know, my core was so diminished by all of us. So like, I always explain it like the onion theory, like we're born into this world as love. And then our first belief is our mom said, you know, our posture isn't right, or we're fat or whatever, or we're not allowed to be validated unless it's by men in private or whatever. And we grow so many beliefs and suddenly we have this huge onion, and who we are as humans, how we actually enter the world is so lost. It's so hard to find because we let everyone else dictate who we are as opposed to just staying close to our truth. And so for me, when I moved to LA, I was 23, 24, one of the other, I can't remember to be honest off the top of my head, but I got to that point of existing so numbly and like having no awareness of who I was as an individual. I was like very deep in drugs at this point, and like just completely existing like with no awareness. And I didn't really like who I was. I didn't like how I was behaving or the actions I was doing or the pain I was causing on my body. And so I had to go away and take the time to get back to my core. And it's taken 4 years, still unraveling all these layers and these beliefs I've had about myself. But yeah, it's not an easy fight. Like, you have to really do the work and you have to figure out where every single layer came from. When was the first time you made that belief that you were fat? When was the first time you made that belief that you didn't have a good singing voice or whatever? And you got to do the work and you got to do the inner child healing. And it's just like, it's never ending, because every single person we meet impacts us subconsciously or consciously, whether we're, you know, whether we're aware of it or not. So yeah, it's a lot. And yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, but.
No, it's good. You made me think of a few things. It you said it went on for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So were the family acting oblivious or ignoring or unaware, or did you try but you were rejected to complain?
So I mean, child sexual abuse, in whether it's in the Arab world or the Western world, it's a taboo. It's a big stigma that most people would rather deny than actually accept the fact that it's happening to their child. And I've spoken to my mom about this on a large scale, and she said she wasn't aware, directly consciously aware, that it was happening, but she wasn't surprised when I told her. And that to me says a lot, because, you know, we were left in these house, like in our house, in our spaces, like completely unsupervised. And like, you know, my parents and my aunties, they'll all be in the kitchen making ahwe and tea and whatever, and they'll just like check in on us occasionally, but they wouldn't, the eyes were never on us all the time. And I think as parents, it isn't easy to do. You can't always be watching your child. And I can't speak to the details just because I do want to protect the people in my family, in my household. But yeah, in my situation, it was something that was easily, like, my parents just assumed I was safe, but it was also ignorant for them to assume I was safe given the context of one of my predators, for instance. And yeah, I don't know.
two points. The first point is, it's usually, like, it's such a common thing, like you said. Unfortunately, it's such a common thing, but extremely unaddressed, because it's very close to home. And I'll say the point is here is that usually it's from the people close to you, whether it's a close friend of the family or an uncle or a brother, or it can be a woman, it can be a man, but it's usually the people you don't expect. Because they know that by default, just because they have a same family name or because they are longtime friends, that everybody assumes that you're automatically safe with them. And this is the scary part. And this is where I think the awareness is growing so much now due to the internet and due to people like you and many who speak. You are, as a parent today, you have to be extremely cautious who the fuck your kid is with around? Who?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter if it's a driver, a nanny, a brother, an uncle, your neighbor, your best friend.
Yeah.
Probably a normal guy, but you don't know how it is. He is with kids. You don't know if there's that fetish somewhere. So that's the first scary part. But I also find it extremely scary that it's not addressed. But I kind of, Sarah, understand. I'll tell you an example. It's kind of like when a man and a woman, they're in a relationship, and let's say the man cheats or the woman cheats, one of them, right? Usually the blame doesn't go on the partner. It goes on to the person they cheated with them. So the girl will beat up the girl instead of beating up her husband or her boyfriend. And you're like, why are you doing that? And I was thinking about this recently, and I'm like, maybe because if they attack their partner, it's kind of like they're attacking their own choice because they chose that person. And now they're let down that your choice was bad. So when you go to a parent and you say, by the way, my uncle or my brother or da-da-da-da-da is abusing me, it's so difficult to acknowledge and accept responsibility. Yeah. You don't want to believe.
Well, I agree and disagree with what you're saying, but I think it stems from, there's a memory that I have where I was like six, and my cousin and I were in the bedroom. We'd been put there to like go to sleep, and someone entered the room and they were being inappropriate. And my cousin and I were laughing, we were giggling because we're young, we don't understand what's happening. Comes in and she, like, I remember there was like screaming and the person left, but then we were still laughing. And so as a result of this, she like hit us with the broom. And so we was technically being punished for what wasn't our choice, what wasn't our decision. And then I highly doubt, I obviously don't remember, and I haven't brought this up to this specific woman, but we ended up being the ones who were punished for what happened. And there was no word of what happened or what that male who entered the room did. So, and there was a lot of the power dynamics between like the man and the woman in my household and my environments. It was like very misogynistic. It was like only what the man wants, and the woman just shuts up and cleans, essentially. So when that happened to me as a child and I was being punished for the actions of man, that's like the woman protecting the man as opposed to protecting the child. And so that's like a very strange conditioning to then grow up with, because I also became that. I became someone who protected men over my inner child. And so like we learn these behaviors and it's not right. These are beliefs that we have to undo in order to come back to ourselves and learn like, well, this doesn't work for me. I'm not going to silence my inner child. I'm going to use my voice and go after that fucking man and hit him with the broom, you know? But it is what it is.
You said, Sarah, that you agree and disagree.
No, I mean, I think, you know, as a society, we're evolving, and I don't think things are as traditional as they used to be, where women are getting stronger and asserting their voices in very male dominant spaces. And yeah, I think, I mean, that's why I agree and disagree, because we are constantly evolving as humans.
Absolutely. I think what you mentioned is so important, is that all of us are extremely programmed, you know, we're conditioned. And you're right, women have been conditioned by hundreds of years to be more the gentle one and the submissive, like you mentioned. And this is an issue, because I was talking to a girl about sexual harassment at work. And we were talking about the intricate details, not like the big actions, like a guy massaging your shoulders every fucking day while you're typing on your computer and he's your boss. And I'm like, you go through that every day? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, wow. And then one story that I was told is that the HR complained to the girl that why are you pretty? You're attracting attention and you're causing issues. And I'm like, instead of controlling the men, who are abusing their power, you're blaming the woman for being pretty by nature? Like, I want to understand, why is the blame going to her when she's just sitting in her office and she's not trying to do anything? She's not being provocative. She's not trying to be tempting people or attention. She's just being normal. And I was like, it's really fucked up that it gets flipped on them. Women get blamed for looking nice or for smiling. You smile, khalas, that means you want them. And I'm like, what? So it was so eye-opening for me to listen to what I know there is sexual harassment, but I never realized, Sarah, how it is literally a daily thing. If you're walking on the street and you're wearing fitted clothes, you'll get some remarks. If you are at work, you get a remark. If you get rejected from a job just because you're attractive, like, what? How? Would a man ever face that because he's handsome? You know, so there's so many of these things, and I don't know, it's a big topic, but I wanted to touch on it because your story is also interesting, you know. So how are you dealing with that since the abuse? How are you dealing with it till today?
I mean, I've been doing the work, so I've been going through that healing process, and this is where I use my art specifically to help me nurture these wounds that I have and these beliefs. Because, you know, when you grow up as a child who has been abused, you have coping mechanisms to deal with what's happened to you in order to survive. And like, for the longest time, I learned that apathy and numbing and anxiety was the way I would cope, completely compartmentalizing my experiences and my emotions and only feeling anxiety. And so I grew up very, very, very anxious, and I never was able to breathe into my belly. I would only breathe into my chest. So constantly in fight or flight mode. And, you know, as you get older and you get traumatized again and you get triggered and all these bad experiences keep happening to you, you eventually end up existing as like a bowl of nothingness, like just complete numb, no awareness, as I mentioned previously. And so, you know, I leaned into, for the longest time, I leaned into like painkillers and like alcohol and all of those things in order to just like continue to exist without even like with zero awareness of what was going on in my world and in my brain. Like, and so, yeah, it wasn't until I moved to LA that I really started to tap into like these wounds and these memories and these experiences. And then I was able to, you know, organize the chaos in my brain and all these thoughts and these traumas into words and then into visuals. And then I was able to tell my story through my art. And yeah, that's for me how I was able to do that. But I don't know.
I saw a video of a poem that you wrote.
Yeah.
Titled, I Could Not Protect Her.
Yeah.
Were you referring to yourself or to your niece?
Was I referring to myself? Is that what you said? Sorry. Yeah.
Were you referring to yourself or your niece?
Both.
Hmm. Can you explain it more?
Not exactly. I just have to be super careful of what I say because I really don't want to put certain people in my family in a position where they could be, you know,
I don't want to talk about your family. I'd rather only because they don't have, they didn't approve to be in this interview. I want to talk about you. So I'd rather just you. So how did it reflect on you?
So I want to say there was a period where I went home for the summer for Christmas. And I witnessed my niece. She came to me and she was just like, Sarah, look what happened to me. And this was when I was like very deep into therapy and my own healing from my abuse as a child. And she came to me and she was just like, I'm scared, like, look what's happened. Mom told me to come to you. And I thought that was very weird. Like, I'm not her mom, I'm her auntie. Like, why would I come Why would her mom send her to me? But this is how much of a stigma it is, like, in our families. And I froze. Instead of being able to, like, you know, get that anger and, like, go after whoever did that to her, I froze. I literally froze. And I went into fetal, like, I was literally already sitting on the floor, and I just, like, grabbed my knees and I just, like, froze and I got teary. And then my mom walks in and she's like, are you okay? And I showed my mom, and we're all kind of just like, we don't know what to do. None of us know what to do because it's not talked about. And something that I suffered with is, like, being able to find safety. And how do I, like, I was never protected. So how can I protect myself? And how can I ever get to that place of feeling safe and not being in fight or flight mode? And yeah, so I left, I went back to LA and nothing was done. And then I was traveling for 4 months and I ended up in Paris and the power was out in my hotel. And it was the first time I was finally, like, still for, like, it was like a night. And it was like the first time I actually was able to, take the time to reflect on what had happened in December. And I just remember just feeling so helpless and so ashamed that I wasn't able to protect my own niece. But then I realized, like, it was coming from my own, like, experiences of not knowing what to do in that situation. And so that whole moment for me was very, like, healing. I burst into tears and I was just, one by one, these words came out, this poem came out. I literally wrote that poem in 2 minutes. 2 minutes, that entire thing, it just poured out of me. And I realized it was all this anger I was holding on to. I was angry at my mom. I was angry at my predators. I was angry at myself. And it just, yeah, it just exploded out of me. And when I read it, I was like, oh, fuck. Like, I have to, like, turn this into a series. And that's how I Could Not Protect Her was born, like, that entire photo series, because I realized I was ready to start talking about my abuse because it had such an impact on the way I exist and the reason why I wasn't able to feel safe in any space, even if I wasn't in danger, because that's what anxiety does to you.
You know, a lot of people, Sarah, who go through trauma or go through difficult experiences, I would say the majority, they fall in the pocket of the victim. They'll feel sorry for themselves. They'll self-destruct. They will blame the world. They'll be depressed. Some will commit suicide. It's a very understandable and easy route to take because there are, you have so many reasons to take it. A few of them are usually the great people that we see around us. They know how to take that trauma and that pain and fuel a passion, whether it's sports, art, work, something. Would you consider yourself one of the few?
I think so. I think that's apparent. Like, I'm not going to deny that. I've mastered the art of expressing myself, and I know I have, and I know I do a great job at it, and it's something that's very natural to me. So yeah, I know I make a difference, and yeah.
You mentioned that you had food, what do they call it? Like food disorders, right? Throw up or you would starve yourself. And I read in an interview that you would do that, Sarah, in terms of trying to keep your body and physique as childlike as possible and you don't want it to grow.
Yeah.
Can you explain?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it comes from two influences. It comes from my experiences of being abused and it comes from Western standards of beauty. And when the first time I was ever validated sexually was as a child, and that's the reality. And so as a woman who's existing in a Western world, when you're receiving like that validation from men, that as a child in your small petite body, like this is how I learned to be valued. Being sexualized as a kid was how I learned to be valued. And as you grow up and as you grow older, I was repressing these memories. So I wasn't even aware. By the time I was like 14, 15, 16, I totally forgot that that was something that I experienced. I repressed it so much. I compartmentalized it. And so subconsciously, all I knew was I needed to appear childlike in order to be sexually validated. And so I didn't want my Arab curves to kick in. I didn't want to appear womanly because subconsciously I had the belief that I would only ever be validated if I looked like my childlike self. So that's from that angle. But then you have Western standards of beauty. I grew up in the 90s. My idols were Kay Moss and Naomi Campbell and fucking Misha Barton from the OC. Actually, she probably caused my eating disorder the most. But like, we were being told as women that in order to be accepted by society, we have to be stick thin and look like we've been doing a bunch of heroin and then just like walk through spaces and, you know, and look like these white women who are Eurocentric, who are blue eyed and cheekboned and like, you know, dark red eyes and just like stick figure. And so these were my role models. And so not only was I subconsciously under the belief that I had to look like a child in order to be sexually validated, but then everything around me was saying the same thing. And so that, and it's not just me, we, so many girls and boys go through this of like wanting to conform to colonized standards. Like you will not be accepted unless you look like this. And so that's how my eating disorders like, I guess escalated, and they still like, you never really recover from it. Like I go through, like right now I'm very healthy, but body dysmorphia is always something, if you have it, it's just, it takes so much to get to that point of just accepting like, oh no, this is what I look like and it's beautiful and it's amazing as it is. But yeah, when you're so whitewashed and then you have these beliefs, it's just, it is really hard to recover, and I don't think you ever fully recover. And so my eating disorders manifested in different ways. As in high school, it was anorexia. In college, it was, I was addicted to the gym. And then like when I got to LA, it was just like straight up throwing up constantly. And like, and then there's also binge eating, and you eat like to fill, and it's just literally, it just manifests in different types of disorders, but it's your way of having control. And it doesn't come from it, like what you look like is the last, because you could get to this goal weight and still be completely unsatisfied. It's all about the reasons why you do it. And for me, it came from wanting control and knowing this is something I could control. And so I like used it as a way of coping. And yeah.
What is, Sarah, what is destructive love?
Oh, this is my specialty. No, I mean, no, in what context though?
Because in your context, because I read it that you went through many relationships that maybe are labeled as ones with destructive love.
Yeah, I mean, so my relationship with love is constantly evolving, because my beliefs growing up was love was very conditional. I was taught love in a way that unless I was submissive and obedient and honoring the male in the situation more than my own needs, then I could never be loved. Like, and so when you grow up as an adult with those beliefs of like conditional love and like learning love from narcissists and people who are very like self, like their needs before anyone else's, you learn to get into relationships where you're extremely codependent. You only want to cater to the other person and you lose yourself in that relationship. And it's toxic, it's destructive, because your needs no longer matter. You put the person that you're in love with like on a pedestal and you just cater to them. And you just become a shell of a human who caters to them. And I want to say, you know, I used to believe that it was always the person I was in a relationship that was toxic to me. But as I've gotten older, I've learned that I'm the one actively choosing to be with people who remind me of the love that I was taught. And, you know, I've only had two serious relationships, and both of them were with very clinically diagnosed narcissists, like very textbook, like toxic humans. And I chose to stay with them. And I, even though I knew that they were master manipulators and I knew I wasn't myself and I was walking on eggshells in order to be with these people, but it was the way I learned love. And so now I actively am trying to break that cycle and making sure that anyone who enters my life, like I still maintain my routine and my schedule and I still see all my friends and then they're just an addition to it. The moment you give up your life and your daily routine and your passions and your friends and your family in order to be with someone, you have entered a toxic relationship, not only with the other person, but with yourself. And it people do that, we do that, I do that because of the way we were taught love. And like, for me, it was conditional love. I never learned to just like receive love for being messy or being angry. I was only ever receiving love for being obedient. And you know, just if someone, like for instance, if my dad was mean to me or mean to someone in my family and he was rude, instead of being angry at my dad, I would like observe that and be like, well, how do I make sure he doesn't do that again? And so I would go and shower him with love and then he would love me back. And that was like a response that I had, instead of doing the normal thing of being like, fuck you, I'm angry. I'd be like, no, I'm gonna go give my dad a hug. I'm just gonna give him love so he loves me back, you know? And it's all these behaviors we learn as a child in order to exist safely. I'll keep saying that, that ends up manifesting into our relationships. And so when I was going and getting into relationships with these narcissistic men, if I was messy or angry or whatever, they would gaslight me and be like, you're crazy, or you're so fucking ugly when you yell like that or whatever. And then I'm like, no, I don't want to be ugly. I don't want to be angry. And so instead of getting mad and walking away, I would just be like, how can I get them to love me? Instead of being like, fuck this, I'm getting the fuck out of here. And yeah, and so it took many years of like learning that this was something that I did in my relationships to know that I never want to do that again. And we have to break that cycle and learn love from scratch and know that love is from within first, and making sure you love yourself enough to not put yourself in situations where you would ever give up yourself or sacrifice yourself to be with someone else.
Absolutely. I mean, you said so many important things, Sarah. You said the fact that your definition of love was based on maybe an abusive or conditional one. And what a lot of teachings say is our first definition of love is our parents. So a son will base love on his mother and the daughter on the father. And if that was, let's say, hard, tough love, then they will seek that kind of partner in the future. And subconsciously, they're like, why am I repeating this abusive cycle? Why can't I just be with someone? And that's where your friend will tell you, oh, I found the perfect guy for you. Look at his CV. He's perfect. 1, 2, 3. And yeah, then you're with that person and he is really good, supposedly, for you. But you're like, why can't I be attracted to him? It's because it's not taking you back to the comfort zone, which is your first love, which is usually. Yeah. And the second thing that I really liked what you said is, the person has to be an addition to your life, not a completion. Yeah. Otherwise, it's a big problem because you're a whole person. You're not an. I get really irritated when somebody says, yeah, he completes me. No, no, you're complete. You don't need somebody to complete you. You can get somebody who compliments you.
Yeah.
So this is a very, maybe we don't focus on that word so much because we're romanticizing the idea of completion. But yeah, you're created whole. You're whole.
Yeah. Who made you feel? You enter the world as love. You are nothing but love when you enter this world. You literally enter with zero beliefs from society. You just know that you are loved and you are whole. And it isn't until you start making these beliefs that you don't become love anymore. You become ego. You become, not ego, sorry, you become negative ego and positive ego and all these like things that stem from mind as opposed to from stemming from soul, right? Because like when I think about it, I really do believe that when you remove your roommate as like, I don't know if you've read Untethered Soul, but like they refer to the mind as the roommate. And it's just like, if you can listen to your mind, you'll realize that it isn't you. You are just you. And then your thoughts are your ego, whether they're positive or negative thoughts. And so, and these thoughts come from beliefs, and they come from like the stories we tell ourselves and whatnot. So when, if you can remove that and just exist as love and go back to your core, then like that's all you'll be, that's all you'll know how to be. But it takes so much work and so much therapy and so much awareness of knowing like when your roommate is just going off at you and when it isn't, you know. But I want to go back to what we talked about in terms of like relationships and love. Like I think healthy love is, and this is something I've been talking about a lot, like especially these past few weeks, because I think I'm gonna it's a concept I'm working on, but the love that we all need to strive for is it's just like people who make you just want to be your best self. And when you're around them, you just feel so fucking good and you feel so accepted, right? And I call these people my hype men and women. So like, and like, I've made sure that in my life today, the only people around me are my hype men and women, people who see me and they know that even if I'm in a chaotic state of mind, they're just like, I accept you. I love you. I nurture you. How can I support you right now? Instead of being like, oh, she's in a mood, let's stay away from her. They're like, come here. I love you. Like, let's all love each other, you know? And because what I'm realizing is, you know, as much as I always want to be this empowered, like boss bitch that gets shit done, like I'm also fucking anxious and I overthink all the time and I get messy and I get dark and I get depressed and I get suicidal sometimes. And like, and I just need to know that the people in my life can handle both versions of me and all the versions in between. And so like, I call the people in my life now hype men and women. And when it comes to intimate romantic relationships, that can't change either. The man that comes into my life has to be my hype man. He has to see me, get down on his knees and like clap as I like walk through life. And I do that for him too, you know? And I think that's healthy love. And that's love we should all strive for. And any second that's compromised, and the person isn't willing to be your hype man, you got to walk away. You got to be like, oh, you're not what I need. You're not what I want.
Lara, it's crazy how many things you're saying that I already say. So it's beautiful to see that it's like our ideas are already attracted because they're similar. And we have now a Zoom call between LA and Dubai. And I'm hearing things that I like to say. I don't say hype man and woman. I say your partner should be your number one fan or one of your number one fans. And you should do the same. And you should do the same. Like imagine, but the problem is, and I just recorded a video for my Instagram that I still didn't post, but it's about this possessiveness that it takes over a human being when they fall in love. And then suddenly it's like removing the flower, because you like the flower, you remove it, but then the flower dies. You should, if you really love the flower, really, without all of this huge ego, you should nurture the flower. You should have put vitamins and soil and sun and water and let them flourish. But then, and I'll repeat this, I'm going to repeat it again, because I love this quote. And you know who Monica Bellucci is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I read this, Wallah Sara, I read this maybe 10 to 12 years ago, something like that. And it's one of those things that never left me. Yeah. And she said in this magazine, when you love someone, whether it be your husband, your lover, your child, don't try to change them. Because if you do succeed in changing them, you might fall out of love with them.
Yeah.
And I wish people just did that. Because if I take you and I'm like, okay, I want to change here and I want to change there and I'll edit here. And then you're not Sara anymore. I like you because you are Sara. Why suddenly I want to change it? Because it will make me feel what? Superior, or I have a big ego and I'm feeding it?
No.
Yeah. Hype man and hype woman is the right.
My friend actually said this to me the other day, but she watched something and she was like, this guy was like, we all get into relationships and we want to change the person to be more like us. So we're constantly like, why do you do that? Because it's like a projection. Like, I would never do that. Why is she doing that? And would I want to be with a person who does what I don't do? So we're constantly trying to change our partners to be more like us. But why would we want to date ourselves? Like, what's the point of that? So I'm here. I'm here. And I will keep saying this, but I I only want people who make me laugh, people who can see me in my darkness and just be light. And, you know, I'll give you an example. One, this happened the other day, but my friend, and this was me trying to be her hype woman in a situation that was just chaos. We were in Mexico, and the receptionist had charged my card and charged her card for like 3 nights, and we only stayed one night. And we're like, are we being conned? Like, what the fuck? You need to like reverse this charge. And I'm not one, I don't get shitty over stuff like that. I'm just like, oh, halas, like, let's just go. It's whatever. We'll figure it out later. But my friend is very, very like strong, opinionated. Yeah, very powerful woman. And she was like, no, we are not leaving until this is sorted. And so she's in the reception yelling, blasting at this woman who is not being nice at all. And I'm just like, and she's making a scene, like people are like, what is going on? And I'm like, how can I best support my friend right now? And I knew earlier we were shopping and she's like, I just want a glass of champagne. I just want to relax. And this was the opposite of that. So I went to a bottle shop. I bought her favorite champagne. I poured it in a coffee cup and put a lid on it. And then I was like, Habibti, this is here for you when you're ready. I'm just going to be over there. Take your time. So instead of being like, girl, shut the fuck up, let's just go, I was like, I know she needs to do this right now. So I'm going to let her do this because it's going to make her feel better after or worse, who knows? But I just know this is something she needs to do right now. So I'm going to support her through this and nurture her in a way that she expressed she needed nurturing earlier on. And like, that was me being a hype woman for my friend. And then like later that night, I snapped at her, and I'm not one to ever snap, but I was so hungry. And I just like, I gave her attitude. And then she looks at me and she's like, oh, we need to get you food. And like, she just went and ordered me fries like that. And it's like understanding like the way the people in your life want to be loved and then wanting to love them in that way, you know? And it's just like you give and you take and you give and you take, but it's just like you have to like, it has to be equal as well. You can't be the one to overcompensate. They can't be the one to overcompensate. It's just like this beautiful reciprocated appreciation for each other. And, but like for all of them, not just like parts of them, you know?
You made me picture a seesaw.
Yeah, that too.
And if we're sitting on a seesaw, I need you to push when I'm down. So I go up, and when you're down, you need to push. You know, like it's, yeah, it's a balance. I'll try to narrow it down because I think me and you can talk for hours.
Probably.
So let's see. Tell me, how was your relationship with money?
Ooh, good question. I guess we grew up middle class. My dad was very wealthy before I was born. He was, I want to say, went in Palestine, in Ramallah and in Qatar. He was building like traffic lights. He was being invited by all these different corporations to build satellites on, like when electricity was just like booming in the Middle East, my dad was there for it and my uncle. And when they moved to Australia, they came with money and, you know, they had investment properties and whatnot. But then my dad's, I guess, like, he was supporting everyone in the family, and then his business wasn't doing well, and then no one supported him throughout that. And so I grew up with a dad who was very resentful. He was very angry. And when it came to money, he wanted to take care of us, but it was coming from a place of like grief, knowing that he wasn't able to provide for us the way he once used to provide for everyone in his life. And so I grew up never wanting to ask my dad for anything. And by the time I was old enough to work and like make my own money, I did. And I want to say after 16, I never asked him for a penny. And so I am, you know, I'm in a very comfortable place financially. And my relationship with money has always stemmed from I do have imposter syndrome sometimes. I'm like, am I supposed to have this money? Do I deserve it? Like, you know, and I always like feel guilty about being able to take care of myself in this way. And I still am trying to figure out where that stems from, where that weirdness like comes from. Why is my relationship with money so hard to accept that I'm allowed to have it? And it's because, like, I guess, you know, the people I used to surround myself with would make me feel like a bit of shame for being successful or not, you know? And so there was always just like, there's these weird beliefs I've had around it, but I'm finally in a place where I'm comfortable to celebrate my wins and I'm comfortable to treat myself like on occasion, but I also want to be, I have that complex that, oh, it could go at any point like it did with my dad. So I want to make sure I'm not spending the way like people would, you know? Yeah, I would say I'm still figuring it out, to be honest. I don't fully know how I feel. I just know that I deserve this. I deserve the success and I've worked really fucking hard for it. And that's what I have to keep reminding myself. Like, I shouldn't feel weird for being in a place that's like abundant. And yeah.
How is your relationship with food now?
Great. I eat everything. I love it. I'm in such a good place. I mean, sometimes I feel a bit, I get uncomfortable if I can see I'm a little like, my body's changed a bit because I've been like complacent or I haven't exercised, but then I really learned to just look in the mirror and be like, you're still a hot bitch. Like, you're fine. That's good. You have love. Like, you know, it's taken years of work, but I, you know, I'm in such a good place and like, you know, the people that I'm around, like they, it's just love. It's just full compliments. Like, everyone's just so accepting and you just don't want to be around people who make you feel like you're not good enough.
Life is short. Why you need that?
Yeah.
What is shame to you?
Shame is feeling like you were something wrong. You were someone wrong. Feeling like you don't, you're not accepted because of your actions and your behavior and your thoughts. Feeling like you were, yeah, feeling like you were wrong for existing as you are.
And what is vulnerability to Sarah?
My entire being. I'm just like an open mess now. Vulnerability is giving yourself permission to be as you are, feel as you are, and communicate as you are. So just allowing it and allowing it without judgment, and making space for the darkness and making space for the light and making it openly.
What are you afraid of?
Right now, what am I afraid of? My safety being removed from me. I'm finally feeling like secure and stable. And it'd just be really unfortunate if someone just came and fucking tore it down. Yeah, because I'm tired.
I'm tired
of rebuilding. Yeah.
You think you'll always be rebuilding?
Yeah, I think that's inevitable. But I think we develop skills to build quicker and build stronger foundations.
Best moment in your life so far?
Oh, I don't know. That's,
Which one pops up?
None. My brain's just like, the best moment in my life.
One of, doesn't have to be the.
Oh God. I want to say when we were in Milan, my closest friend and I, this is so rare, I don't even know why this came up, but she'd just been on a 23-hour flight from Australia to get to me for our summer holiday. And we were staying in my client's house, which is this really big, beautiful penthouse. And she opens the door. She's still in her airport clothes. She has like a thin jacket on. And I'm giving her the tour because I'm like, this house is crazy. Like, let me show you. Da, 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 da. And I was like, and this is our room, and there's like a balcony that wraps around the whole house. And so I'm showing her, and she opens the door, and I'm like, look at this. And then I see her closing the door, and I was just like, Bahar, no, don't close it. And it just shuts, and we're locked out completely. We can't get back into the house. It's so comical. There was a butler in this house, and he's deaf, so he couldn't hear us. Our phones were inside the house, and my client wasn't coming back till the next day in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And then there was this guy who was staying in the guest room, and he decided to stay out of town for the night. So me and her, my most favorite human in the world, were stuck on a terrace. And I hadn't seen her in like 6 months, and we had nothing but a thin jacket and each other. And we ended up being stuck out there for like 12 hours overnight, and we got rained on. We found solace under a table, and like with this thin blanket, just hugging each other. But we just look at each other and we're just like, of course this happens to us. And it was just that moment of like, it doesn't matter where we are, as long as we're together. It doesn't matter what the situation is. And it was just feeling that pure wholeness in a situation that could have easily been ugly and terrifying, you know? I think that's one of the best moments. It's like, it just brings me so much joy to think about, as like, and knowing that we could just be so peaceful and calm in such a shitty situation. I think that's special.
It's actually one of the best stories I've heard regarding that question, because I ask it always. Imagine being stuck with somebody you don't like.
I know, that'd be terrible. Or you could walk out of their lovers or best friends, who knows?
Yeah, unfortunately, after such a good story, I'm going to switch to the worst moment in your life.
Worst moment. There's been too many. That one's easy. I'm like, oh, which one? Life gets really fucking dark. There's moments of feeling like you're just so like alone. And when I moved to LA, I really struggled to feel like I had a sense of community. I always felt like I was just doing everything alone. I was simply just surviving and trying to stay here. Like when you're going through the initial stages of like unpacking your trauma, and you're diving into these like memories of your childhood, like I happened to be doing those with no community around me. I had like one or two friends that I saw on occasion, but it was really just me alone in this house, just doing the work and then going to therapy. And when you go sober for the first time as well, and you don't have like this, your muses to escape, like you literally just have to deal with everything. I think that to me is like, it's the worst moments, because it's like feeling all your pain for the first time at once, like all of it just explodes, and it's so heavy. And honestly, like there were so many times where I didn't think I'd make it to the next day. Like it was just so overbearing. And when you're doing it alone, that's like, cause you only have yourself to fight. Like, who am I? Why am I still here? Like if it's just me, like, do I actually need to be here? Do I need to go through this? But that's also the best thing, because it taught me to lean into my art and to tell my story. And had I not done that, I wouldn't have any of the abundance that I have now, and that healing and that wholeness. Like, so yeah, it's the worst, but it also is the best. To be able to give yourself permission to go that deep and to get that dark and heavy, and then to come out light and just like move through spaces with like a load off your shoulder, that's the best. So, yeah.
Did you ever try to kill yourself?
No, not all the way. Not all the way. There's definitely, I've been strong enough to just not go to that next level. Like I've been able to call on people when I was about to get there, or when I was there, and just be like, I'm not doing that, but I do need you to come over. I do need you to come get me. You just got to push through. You got to keep fighting, you know?
Of course.
Yeah.
Do you have any regrets?
No.
Good. I had a question that I want to ask, but you gave me another one. Okay. Hypothetical question.
Mm-hmm.
We take Sarah's heart.
Mm-hmm.
We place it in front of you here, in front of you. What would your heart tell you?
Stop smoking.
That's your lungs, not your heart.
No, it's all of it. It's connected. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. It would say, thanks for keeping me alive. You're doing fucking great. It would just be like, you kill me sometimes, but kudos to you.
Describe your mother in one word.
Resilient. Yeah.
Okay. And what about Sarah in one word?
Disruptive. Yeah.
First time I get that word.
Yeah, what do you normally get?
Anyway, variety, but not that one. I want to thank you. No, really, thank you for sharing what you were willing to share, although we've never met before.
Thank you for allowing the space to be vulnerable.
I think you're vulnerable with or without me, so it's good.
No, thank you. This has been such a pleasure. I really enjoyed diving in, even though I'm so tired today. thank you.
Inshallah.
Let's meet in Dubai. Yeah.
I was literally going to say that. Hopefully in Dubai, like this would have been also a pleasure to just be here in the studio and listen to you. I think it usually is very different when also we're face to face with people. The energy is intense. So many people break down, men and women, and they start crying and they start talking. It's because it's two human beings just, you know, being raw and intimate. But I still think each chapter has to have, I don't want everybody to cry in every chapter, but sometimes it's beautiful. Sometimes you want it to be also very strong. Like today, I saw that you're fucking strong. Like, I'm proud to see how strong you've been, how resilient, like your mother, since that's the word you gave her. You're the same, you know, and it's really beautiful to see that you're working on yourself. You have hope for Sarah. You want to help people, whether it's through art or through being so brave to use your words. It's so difficult. And considering the context of being Arab and all of this, and your family won't agree or friends, it takes a lot, Sarah. So, you know, thank you for being yourself, and hopefully a lot of women will benefit from this, and men, I think.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's so kind.
Yalla, we'll talk to you soon.